Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Danny, have you been watching any exciting movies lately?
I've seen two films. One's very commercial with I can't see anyone disliking. One of them was incredibly arty, almost unwatchable to 90% of the population.
Okay.
Which one do you want to hear about?
Well, you're a true cineast, aren't you?
Yeah, it's me.
You've got high and low brow tastes.
All the brows.
Which was better? Tell me that.
I watched Girls Trip.
Yeah.
It was a huge smash last year. It's very funny. I think it's not unfair to call it like an African-American Bridesmaids, similar sort of thing where like four women, they were like mates at uni, they've gone separate ways. Some, you know, there's been some arguments in the past and over a weekend, this is all going to, you know, come to a head.
Uh-huh.
But like, just, yeah, kind of hilarious. Very like broad, really crass humor. It's a bit like, in Bridesmaids, the scene where they like shit themselves.
Yes.
It's like some humor like that, which I'm a big fan of. Women can be well disgusting done. As well. Why not? We all shit, don't we? We all poop.
That's what the films have taught me lately, thanks to these comedies.
And the big breakout star is Tiffany Haddish. You can see why. She's absolutely hilarious in it. There's definitely like a lot of her lines seem like ad-libs, where there was like one joke and she put like two more on it.
So she's the Melissa McCarthy of the gang.
Yeah. There's one amazing, like, part of the plot line is that the most successful member of the quartet, who's like the sort of life advice guru type, her husband, played by Mike Coulter, Luke Cage from the Marvel show, big huge dude, mm-hmm. very sexy guy. It turns out he's having an extramarital affair, and Tiffany Haddish, like, there's a bit where she just describes like the vengeance she's gonna wreak on him, and it's obviously all ad-libbed, and it's just hilarious. Maybe I'll put a clip of it in. Why not?
Don't worry, boo. I'm gonna put hands on him. I'm talking hot grits, extension cords, Timberland boots. I'm gonna fuck up that bitch's Instagram account. I'm gonna put two Q-tips in his pee-pee hole and I'm gonna walk him around. I'm just swiping that thing and I'm gonna yank him out. And then I'm gonna stick my fingers up in his ass and tell him I'm checking his prostate, but really I'm gonna yank his balls off the back of that motherfucker. And then I'm gonna put my fist so far up his ass, I'm gonna pull his heart out through that motherfucker and I'm gonna nabby-dye, shufty-day that shit just boop, 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 boop. And then I'm gonna stick my fingers back up in his ass, and then I'm gonna twirl him around and see if that make him giggle a little bit. You know, because I like to make a motherfucker laugh when I hurt him. You know what I'm saying?
Very funny. That's going to be when it's in the edited version of the podcast.
So watch that. I would very much recommend it. I think it's on. You can get it on iTunes. And I also watched this film, Strain Andromeda The, which is the 1971 film, The Andromeda Strain. Reordered, so the last shot is the first shot and the first shot is the last shot,
so like every shot it runs forwards but is structured backwards. It's like Memento.
Yeah, exactly. Made by this San Franciscan art house artist filmmaker called Anne McGuire, and it was kind of good. It's weirdly compelling. It's like it starts off really funny because the last like 5 minutes is like sort of ticking clock thing where you feel like pull this lever and there's like a computer voice says like self-destruct in like 1 second, and like he just keeps like, getting further and further away from it. And then some of the bits are just incomprehensible.
Have you seen the original film?
No.
The correct way around?
I have not.
But how did he select this film to give this treatment?
Anne McGuire.
Oh, sorry, Anne McGuire. How did she pick the movie to do this with?
I'm not sure. I think maybe because the film is like, it's kind of like this procedural, and it's all about process. Like, the plot is basically this alien substance lands in a town and kills almost everyone apart from two people. Some scientists come, get the two survivors, then go to a lab and try and work it out. That's like the entire film. And I think it was perhaps quite new in its day in that it was going for like a quasi-documentary style not shot like a documentary, but in that, like, there's a lot more scientific process than is, like, dramatically interesting, but kind of accurate.
Right, I see, yeah.
But I think he was better in Reverse Almost. I mean, I can't make this comparison because there's, like, a lot of them, like, doing sciencey stuff. And it's like, you don't realize how deep the woods was until you got out of it. But if you're watching The Right Way Around, it'd be like, this scene's going on too long. But you don't know how long the scenes are because they're going backwards.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, at the end, like, because it starts with them assembling the team and it's like, you know, the scientist is in the middle of an experiment. It's like, you know, the army turn up. It's like, we need you. So, like, it's actually the most fast-paced right at the beginning of the movie, which is the end of the reverse one.
Interesting.
So it kind of did speed up weirdly towards...
So it climaxes.
It climaxed in a sort of odd way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of... I don't know. You have to be in the right mood for it, but it was pretty good. It was at the close-up center in Brook Lane. Probably the most hipster cinema I've ever been to.
How would you describe the mood that you have to be in for this film?
Just...
I'm in a real backwards kind of mood.
I don't know, just in a slightly... Just an open mind and, you know...
Open heart.
Patient and not tired.
Yeah.
Perhaps if you're a bit sleepy going in, it's got I don't know, it's a bit of a sort of loopy feel to it. Like if you're a bit, I can imagine falling asleep in it. If you weren't, it's not going to grip you. You have to sort of engage with it. So
were you kind of prepared for it by the coolness of the cinema? You're like, now I'm ready to watch some weird arty shit.
Yeah, everyone here seems pretty cool. They've like their close-up center is like a rental shop as well. And all the DVDs, I hadn't heard of half of them. I was like, this place is really cool.
Even you hadn't heard of half the DVDs.
Even me, and I've seen like all loads. The films. I've seen all the Alien films, all the Fast and
seen
Furious
seen all the Lord of the Rings films.
All of the Lord of the Rings.
Have you actually seen all the Fast and Furious films?
No. I've seen...
Don't fucking lie to me. You can't get that past me.
Seen 1, 2, 5, and 6.
Well, that's pathetic.
Anyway, Sam, on a complete sequitur, what is... the premise of this podcast, I've completely forgotten.
I'm glad you asked, Danny. This is a podcast all about you. You're the center of the podcast. Dr. Moran, a man who has invented a computer microchip he plans to use to train dogs instantly. However, his former colleague, Dr. Foster, that's me, has other plans for the microchip. I want to implant copies in every child in order to brainwash them to come work for me after they turn 18 and be exceedingly loyal. In the fight between you and my henchmen, Hanky and Panky, you get injured and your dog Lenny is injected with a computer microchip. On the run, Lenny finds his brain power growing. And when he finds a young boy, Zach, to be his friend and savior, Lenny discovers he can talk. Lenny... continually amazed by the new powers the embedded microchip keeps giving him. Zach, full of unrequited love for longtime friend Becky, and school newspaper reporter Becky, out to write the story of the century, team up with a downtrodden police officer called John Wyndham to defeat Dr. Foster and his henchmen. Here's what I would be saying if this was a adaptation of the 2004 film Lenny the Wonder Dog, starring Andy Richter and Craig Ferguson. Instead, it's a podcast in which we talk about and review films. I'm Sam Foster, and joining me, a sort of comical madcap professor, Danny Moran.
Hello. Hello. On this episode of Film Chat, we review Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here, starring Joaquin Phoenix. In many ways, it's a companion piece to Joaquin's own mock documentary, I'm Still Here. In both, he has massive beards. Both sort of feature his relationship with his father. And both have a bit where he goes on Letterman and just caves his skull in with a claw. We'll also be discussing Annihilation, the Alex Garland movie which was unceremoniously dumped on Netflix for being way too smart. It's a sort of mind-bending sci-fi film about a group of female scientists entering a forest that's been altered by some kind of alien thing. Critics are calling it Bring It On, Meet Solaris. They're not doing that, I just made that up. We also discussed the news of a fantastic sounding film from the makers of Logan and roll our eyes so far backwards that we're looking at our own brains and our brains are not happy about the latest flurry of casting news surrounding this His Dark Materials TV adaptation, all of which should give me just enough time to tell you about my latest film. The title is deliberately designed to piggyback off the success of You Were Never Really Here. It's called You Were Never Really There. It's a portmanteau film which consists of a series of live-action reenactments of anecdotes I've clearly made up about how I've been at these cool parties, all of which prompt the response from my friends, "You were never really there." I brag about being at the VMAs that year when Kanye was rude to Tay Sway, and everyone's like, "You were never really there." And then I waxed lyrical about how I met Bradley Cooper at the 2013 Wimbledon final. And everyone's like, you were never really there. And then I talk about how I got drunk with Halle Berry after the Kingsman Golden Circle panel at Comic-Con. And everyone's like, you were never really there. And there's another 24 anecdotes. And
but there's
got to
be a bit at the end where, you know, you reach down and you unveil a box of keepsakes and it's got like the Statesman whiskey. And it's like, how did I get this?
I was there.
And it's got, you know, I don't know.
I was really
there.
You've
got Kanye West toe in there. And it's like, how did I get this? I was at the VMAs.
Do you know what?
He was handing them out. He's a fucking maverick.
he's only 10. Limited edition.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris Young and Olivia Waring both sent us a fascinating article where there's this fella called Michael J. Brenner. He's a journalist, and in the 70s he had what he describes as a consensual sexual relationship with a dolphin, and he wrote a sort of fiction book based on that called Wet Goddess.
It's fictional.
Well, it's fictional but based on truth,
sure,
as much as we know. And he was also the subject of an award-winning documentary called Dolphin Lover. Pretty great name. And so the Oscars were kind of boring and there wasn't that many hot takes to get. So they just thought, well, who would have the best opinion about The Shape of Water, in which Sally Hawkins' mute caretaker has sex with like a fish man? A guy who's fucked a dolphin.
Mm.
So it's an interview with him giving his sort of two cents on the movie, and the interviewer sort of quizzing him about how, you know, he thinks the movie might improve the public opinion around interspecies relationships.
Yeah.
And it's a very entertaining read. I do think he actually does highlight some interesting points about the movie. Like, he's asked this question, the interviewer says, a lot of people have focused almost entirely on the fact that the movie depicts Eliza having sex with this fish man. I'm just curious what your reaction to that is. To which he replies, given the course of the development of the relationship, it seems sort of natural. Although I must say, I find a dolphin a lot more sexy than that thing was. Then again, I'm not Eliza. Maybe you have to take it where you can get it. Which I think actually kind of brings into question the fact that I think a reading of the movie is that
she can't
find an actual boyfriend.
So she has to settle for a fish god.
And not only a fish god who is like, she rescues. So he's sort of like...
So it's not easy. It was an easy D to get. You got to really fucking go out of your way.
The only other guy who shows
It's a bit transactional as well.
Yeah,
I see
exactly.
What you mean, yeah.
And the only other guy who shows any sexual interest to her is like sort of insane Michael Shannon character.
He's evil.
Yeah. What, so if you're mute, you can't find a nice... She's a very attractive, lovely woman, as the film portrays her. What, you're saying she just can't find a man?
Do you think that, given there's a kind of Beauty and the Beast parallel, right?
Yeah, sure.
But in the Beauty and the Beast story, there is that element does not exist. And maybe that... Do you think that film would be weirder? It would be like having Quasimodo from The Hunchback of Notre Dame plus Beauty and the Beast or something like that, where it's like the two outsiders get together and then it just like emphasizes their outsider status.
Yeah.
And it's like, say the disabled woman belongs with the fish man. They're kind of in the same category.
Yeah, exactly. Like, all this sort of oppressed minorities are smudged into one like weird morass.
That's a bit messed up.
I like this bit later on in the interview. And he just says, referencing a previous bit in the interview, you said to me the fact that this won Best Picture, that's just astonishing. It just shows to what degree it is a fantasy. And she says, I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little more. Do you think that if the relationship had been depicted as less fantastical, people would have been less accepting? To which he says, oh yes, definitely. The closer something comes to bestiality in a person's mind, the more it's going to be rejected in the typical case. Gamera carefully set up a very fantastic atmosphere for the film with very realistic elements in it, like Eliza's life. The whole laboratory that the women work at is a fantastic fantasy. Most marine research labs look nothing like that, which is true, I imagine. I'm sure a lot of the good liberals who criticize me for making love with a dolphin loved this film because the hero was a featherless biped. If the asset had been a dolphin, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as popular.
That's true.
Do you think Guillermo del Toro pulled his punches?
He didn't. He made the fish man too sexy.
Too sexy and human-like.
You could imagine having sex with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably true. If it was like a giant spider or something, the film would be a lot more odd, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Or if it was like just a gelatinous cube or some, you know, something hideous. Or it was just sort of sentient moss on a rock that sort of winked at you. You know, I don't know.
That would have been much better. That's what a true artist would have done. Well, I think the best thing about this interview is that, like, the guy, like, his manner is like, I'm not a weirdo, okay, right? And then, like, just says something incredibly weird. So the interview says, Dolly was the name of the dolphin he shagged in the 70s. Uh-huh. And, like, the interview says, does the fact that Dolly was a female have anything to do with your attraction to her? Do you think you'd be attracted to the male dolphins? Like,
That's a good question.
He's like, no, I wouldn't be sexually attracted to male dolphins. As an adult, I'm heterosexual, although I cross species lines. As a teenager, as I wrote about in my memoir, there was a time in my life where I was jerking off to the family dog, a male poodle. But it wasn't because I was gay. It was because his excitement got me very excited, and I found it pleasurable for both of us. If the female poodle had been as responsible as he was, I probably would have been bonking her.
Jesus Christ. This guy's fucking... Just when you think maybe you're getting on board with him.
Yeah, you're not at work. I wouldn't fuck a male dolphin. That's insane. Surely I jerked up to a dog and I'd fuck a dog if it was a woman.
Oh my goodness.
Maybe, you know, maybe in 20 years' time we'll listen back to this podcast and think, God, how ignorant we were.
We were like slave owners who thought the Africans were subhuman or whatever. Doesn't he make that kind of argument?
Absurd. So anyway, I think the bottom line is that even if you fucked a dolphin, it doesn't mean you have more of insight into the film The Shape of Water.
Well, a little bit. Sounds like you made some good points. Although probably nothing you didn't cover in your review, and you've never fucked a dolphin.
I don't think you have to fuck a dolphin to really get the nuances.
You should fuck a dolphin and see if it gives you a different perspective on the film. Maybe gives you some new insights.
Yeah, sure, I'll fuck a dolphin. Yeah, why not?
I have to say that, you know, you can read into this what you like about me. But I feel like there's something that's more acceptable about the existence of this book than if it was a different animal. I feel like dog lover would not, it just is too disgusting, you know? If he fucked a dog, people would be like, there's nothing cute about it. This, like, sleek sea creature, it's kind of cuter, so I think it's okay.
Well, isn't
you can
perceptions...
write this thing called Wet Goddess, and it's, like, obviously gross and, you know, ridiculous, but at the same time, it's not as bad as if it was, like, if he was, like, slug fucker or something.
Yeah, I think it's because dolphins have this reputation of being super smart, right?
So and also very promiscuous.
So it would have been consensual, right? Whereas if you fucked the dogs are just like people, you know, they probably wouldn't know what they're doing. It'd be like being a pedo fucking.
You have to imagine that you think it's more, you know, comprehensible to the human mind that a dolphin would be able to consent to sex because they're so fucking smart.
Yeah. What else super smart? Like chimps?
Bonobo?
Yeah.
Or bonobo, whatever?
Yeah, bonobo.
But it's, there's something, acceptable. But you don't want to think about this guy fucking a bonobo. I feel like the fucking the dolphin is a somehow more acceptable image. That's my take on this anyway. Go on, sue me. Go on, troll me online for my outrageous bestiality views.
Not at all.
Well, you with me on this?
I'm 100%,
climbing down.
I'm 100% with you.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Solidarity. Really appreciate it. Superhero films announced, casting rumors leaking out. M. Night Shyamalan's film is hated, Paul Thomas Anderson's is fated, Meryl Streep's Oscar tipped, Matt Damon's in a viral vid, Michael Bay's made a mint, that's the news that's fit to print. A while ago on the podcast we talked about the news that the BBC were going to make a sort of lavish 8-episode version of his Dark Materials, having previously been made, well, the first book of the series, which I call The Northern Lights, because I'm not American, which was made into The Golden Compass, which didn't do very well and was shit and everyone's forgotten about. Yeah.
But the news that was going to be a BBC adaptation was met with some, like, could be good, you know, more time.
Well, yeah, exactly. Given the full TV treatment.
And some news has been announced. Jack Thorne, who was a writer on Skins and Glue and wrote the Harry Potter play and a bunch of acclaimed
stuff.
Very
in demand. He's doing all sorts of stuff.
Doing all sorts of stuff. Is writing it. And Tom Hooper, director of King's Speech and Les Miserables, and the Danish Girl has been announced as the director of the series. And Lin-Manuel Miranda, everyone's favorite triple threat guy, the Hamilton guy, is going to play Lee Scoresby.
Interesting casting.
And Daphne Keane, who was the only good thing about Logan, who was the sort of breakout star, is going to play Lyra. And I discovered she's actually English.
Oh, cool.
She was Mexican, but she's just bilingual English. She's very, which is pretty good casting, actually. Out of all the news, I'm like, yeah, sure. She had a good scowl. I could see her as a feisty Lyra Balacqua.
Yeah.
However, Lin-Manuel Miranda as Lee Scoresby, that's terrible, terrible casting.
Well, it's weird. I mean, I guess Lee Scoresby isn't such a critical character that you can't, like, mess around with him a bit or whatever. But you really think, given everything about him is, like, this Yosemite Sam type,
there. Yeah, I mean, one of the Sam Elliott's casting as him in The Golden Compass was actually pretty good.
He looked like Philip Pullman had based the character on that actor, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He looked like Philip Pullman had watched The Big Lebowski or something and then been like, that guy.
That guy.
Yeah. He's a character in my film now.
Exactly. And, I mean, as written, I mean, who knows? Maybe they've changed it drastically, but he has to be kind of like an older guy. And Lin-Manuel Miranda's like only in his late 30s and looks younger. He's quite boyish looking, I think.
Yeah.
And there's like part of his character is like the fact that he's like an old guy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Got a little weight to it.
Do you think he's going to do it with like a sort of comedy southern accent? Or,
oh, God, I don't know.
Or will he just rap a lot?
And I don't like Tom Hooper at all.
No.
He kind of sucks. I'm really hoping it doesn't mean he's going to cast like Eddie fucking Redmayne as Lord Asriel or something.
I saw about half an hour of his Les Mis over Christmas.
Yeah.
And it was really hard. It was a real slog.
Yeah, grim.
It's so fucking grim. It's like I, Daniel Blake, but as a musical or something, you know?
Jesus.
It doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know why it's supposed to be such an unpleasant watch. I haven't actually seen the stage show. I mean, I don't know if, like, the stage show, they're all covered in mud and crying all the time, but it felt a bit like that watching the thing. I was like, this cannot be the most serious, dramatic film of all time when it is also has constant, like, catchy show tunes in it.
Yeah.
There's something off about that.
Yeah, maybe it just only works as a musical. Like, you need the live performers to give it a bit of...
Well, in the music... Because you're in, like, the musical world and you kind of buy into the tone of it and therefore, you know, you can invest a lot of pathos in, like, tunes that are like... Whereas if you're watching a movie where everything is incredibly verite, then it just seems weird, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, how do you have the energy to do these lovely songs, you know? You're a miserable person on the verge of death.
Why do you find
this
time?
Doesn't make sense.
You're a real get up and go for someone living in absolute poverty.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the other thing that is slightly puts me off this is because I thought it was going to be like a series per book, but they're going to do all of them in 8 parts, which is just the same as doing 3 movies.
Yeah, you're right. That sucks.
Yeah, why not?
How they, there's so much to pack in.
But the thing is, by the nature of what happens in the books, they're going to have to be huge, like the effects laden. You'd need the budget of a movie to make it. So how are they going to get the money back, you know? Like, if this could just be on the Beeb,
yeah.
How much money did the Night Manager make for them, you know? Like, don't you need the ticket sales to justify...
Won't, like, every episode be on a dramatically different set with, like, you know, everything will be completely different all the time? Like, the third book takes place across multiple different worlds.
Yeah.
It just seems odd,
yeah. All the demon stuff, all the shape-shifting animals all the time.
There's, like, a million characters.
I'm pretty sure every shot would have to be an effect shot. I just don't know, like, how, you know, even on Game of Thrones money, it'd be pushing it, surely?
I don't think. Definitely. Well, it is more ambitious than Game of Thrones. I mean, half those scenes just take place in halls and they're just, you know.
Exactly.
They're just in costumes. They sit in a room and chat. Most of the first series, there's like a couple of big bits, but for the most part, they're just in their old armor and stuff sitting around yakking away.
Yeah.
Most of the budget, you know. The reason it looks like an expensive show is there's loads of blood and like women get their kit off in it.
Oh yes. I remember. So I'm cautiously cynical about that.
Yeah, that does, it doesn't. It's a shame. It's a shame because it was. It's a great yarn.
I basically just wanted like Peter Jackson at the height of his powers to make it. I just wanted like the Lord of the Rings version of those books in my head, like. I remember in the advertising for his Golden Compass, it was like the One Ring flipping and becoming the compass, and it's like, prepare for a new epic.
They were so clumsy about it, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was literally had the ring, and it was like, now it's the compass.
But, you know, I don't know. I think maybe because the Lord of the Rings movies exist and they're so good, it's like, you must be able to, like, they did it with, like, a hugely unwieldy fantasy tome before, and this one's got, you know, loads of good stuff in it. Like, similar, loads of characters, loads of adventure, you know, they're beloved for a reason, and they're, you know, and they're very pacey, like you can see them as movies, I think.
Well,
like,
that's the thing, that's why it seems weird to cram them into 8 parts, is that they're written like pacey adventures, so you know, things happen all the time. They're kind of episodic as well.
Yeah,
the first one's like she goes to a place, has a little adventure, goes to another place, has an adventure there. It would really suit TV.
Yeah.
Like a full, you know, a full series treatment. So it does seem like a bit of a shame.
Mental.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the films from last year that Danny and I did not care for was Logan, James Mangold's angry, bitter Wolverine movie. You know, the most miserable, gritty, realistic film about real problems in the superhero universe that you've ever seen in your life. And James Mangold is circling a new project, and it sounds like hilarious. I mean, I can't see this story earlier today because I was looking for things for us to talk about. And everything about this is funny. It basically sounds like Police Squad or something, or like Naked Gun, but like just like not a joke. Like it sounds absurd. So it's called The Force. Have you read Don Winslow's The Force?
No, sorry.
And it's going to be gritty. Birth Movie's Death described the novel as unpredictably twisty and packed with more grit than a dozen DC films. It is the best crime novel that the guy's read in years. It's gritty. We like the grit in Logan. It's fucking gritty as hell. It's literally set in the desert, wherever there's literally grit in everything. So this is even going to be even grittier than that. Here is what the novel is about.
All Danny Malone wants is to be a good cop. He is the king of Manhattan North, a highly decorated NYPD detective sergeant and the real leader of the Force. It's written here with a D, like that. It's written the Force. Malone and his crew are the smartest, the toughest, the quickest, the bravest, and the baddest. An elite special unit given unrestricted authority to wage war on gangs, drugs, and guns. Every day and every night for the 18 years he spent on the job with a capital J, Malone has served on the front lines, witnessing the hurt, the dead, the victims, the perps. He's done whatever it takes to serve and protect in a city built by ambition and corruption where no one is clean. Including Malone himself. What only a few know is that Danny Malone is dirty. He and his partners have stolen millions of dollars in drugs and cash in the wake of the biggest heroin bust in the city's history. Now Malone is caught in a trap and being squeezed by the feds. And he must walk the thin line between betraying his brothers and his partners, the job, the family, and the woman he loves, trying to survive body and soul, while the city teeters on the brink of a racial conflagration that could destroy them all.
Oh, God.
Struggling to get through that one. I actually was tearing up a bit. It's very, everything's going on there. I really like the way it turns racial right at the very fucking end. Racial conflagration. Sounds like it's going to be delicately handled. Danny Malone, he's a good cop, but he's also twisted. But stolen drugs. It sounds fucking so shit. And here's, if you didn't think, you know, you thought maybe, it sounds like a bit silly, but perhaps it'll be written by a script by somebody who's like got a good handle on these things and might do a more sensitive, interesting, nuanced takes on like racial dynamics and the police force. The screenplay is being written by David Mamet, described here as the legendary David Mamet, a man who may once have, you know, been a good and interesting writer, but has gone way off the deep end and became insanely right wing in the last like 20 years or so.
Yeah, he's nuts.
He wrote some book called something like How I Used to Be a Stupid Liberal Fuckhead and Now I'm Smart, something like that. So yeah, it just sounds so stupid.
Yeah, it's so it's like there's a whole contingent of directors which I'd like put James Mangold in it and same like David Ayer. And
well, it sounds very David Ayer, actually, doesn't it?
It's just like people who have watched Heat way too many times.
Yeah.
And I only watch my favorite movies are like The French Connection and nothing else. I've only seen movies from the 70s about guys. I'm going to make my own version. And I don't care if the world has drastically changed in
exactly,
the past 40 years.
Exactly.
That's the way I'm making the movie.
You can't just make some completely straightforward movie about fucking gritty cops on the job and they're a bit crooked or whatever. It's like, are you serious?
Also, this sounds basically like the plot of The Shield, and that ran for 7 seasons. I think that maybe that premise has been exhausted. The whole like LA Rampart thing of like corrupt cops, such a 90s thing.
Or indeed the film Rampart.
Or indeed the film. I'm trying to think of the film. It's about Rampart in LA. I believe it's called The Man Who Was Corrupt. It feels, unless it's going to be a period piece,
it's kind of LA Confidential as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all the same shit.
The secret is Denny's actually corrupt. No fucking shit.
If you're making a thing about how the cops are corrupt, the hero shouldn't be a cop. They should be the bad guys of your film.
It should be
that's
like
that's my opinion.
Yeah, it should be like the really straight-laced accounting nerd who brings them down.
Yes, exactly.
And they always take the piss out of the whole movie, and then he like gets them on the numbers, number crunches them.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
My favorite film stars Bridget Bardot. She's the queen, but she wants to be in radio. So she starts a podcast with her friends, and the terrorists try to stop her, but she beats them in the end.
So, Annihilation. This is Alex Garland's second directorial film after Ex Machina, which was very well received. Not by me, but by other people,
yeah.
The intelligentsia. And this is based on a book by Jeff Vandermeer. And the plot is that a asteroid has landed somewhere on, in sort of, it suggests a kind of Florida region of America, and it has caused the surrounding area to change and mutate in a strange alien way. And it's like this little, it's referred to as the shimmer. And whatever goes inside the shimmer does not come out.
Does not come out.
Related to this is Natalie Portman is a biologist, and before the movie starts, her husband, played by Oscar Isaacs, has gone missing, and a year later he turns up, and it turns out he went into the shimmer, and he gets very ill, and she realizes the only way to save him will be going into the shimmer, and she goes along with a sort of, it's like a man on a mission movie, but with, instead of men, women, and they include Jennifer Jason Leigh as the sort of ball-busting head of the operation, Tessa Thompson as a physicist, Gina Rodriguez as a sort of cool army bro, and an actress called Tuva Novotny as a another member of the team. I don't know them.
She is a surveyor and geologist.
A surveyor, yeah. They've all got different, you know.
They're all scientists.
They've
aren't
got skills, and this is, yeah. And they go into the shimmer, and stuff happens. Here is a clip of Oscar Isaacs mysteriously returning home at the beginning of the movie.
No one knew anything about your unit. I contacted everyone I could. The other partners knew just as little as me. Pakistan again.
I don't know where it was or what it was.
How is that possible? You must be able to tell me something. You vanished off the face of the earth for 12 months. I deserve a better explanation than no explanation.
Does it matter?
Yeah, so this film, it came out in the US and got a theatrical release there, but Paramount were obviously not very, you know, excited about its prospects, and they ended up selling it to Netflix for distribution outside the US. So the suckers in the UK are not able to see this on the big screen. Annihilation has been shrunken down and reduced in file size and made look shitter, but it's very convenient to watch because you just watch on Netflix, you don't have to pay for it. So for humble podcasters, it's very handy. I haven't seen Ex Machina. I remember it coming out, and remember you didn't much care for it. And then you watched this movie before me and said that it was, you know, not all that. So I would say my expectations were relatively dampened. I watched it this afternoon, so I haven't had a, you know, chance to think deeply about this. And I know it's a very intellectual film with huge, great themes. So I might have just missed all the good shit and I'm just, you know, too dumb for it. And then tomorrow I'm going to wake up and be like, Garland's a genius. I'm a moron. I have to re-record the podcast and I'm just going to cause all sorts of trouble for us. But assuming that doesn't happen, I was not particularly amazed by it. I thought it was fine. I thought it was kind of okay. It definitely has a certain amount of genre thrills. It's a, you know, it's a kind of genre movie, and it has a central concept with regards to the kind of crazy shit that goes on in the shimmer as they're wandering around and they're encountering all sorts of odd things. And there's that sci-fi pleasure of just seeing the creativity in how they spin out the idea. And they have different encounters, and it's like, you know, there's some interest in seeing all the different ways that he's found to do things, and some moments of oddness, and he's obviously enjoyed painting all these different like weird moments and stuff that's come out of his like central concept. But it is very derivative of other things, and it's very hard to watch without being reminded of a million different other things that have obviously influenced him. And although it has, you know, big themes in a kind of superficial way, it doesn't seem to be saying that much. It's just this kind of decoration, a garland, if you if you will, which, you know, kind of ties the film together in a sort of like I've read Robert McKee's story type way, but it's not really saying something in particular about, you know, life or existence or, yeah, you know, It's just all connecting the dots. It's just a way to construct a story out of it. So it doesn't end up feeling particularly impactful, and it's rather cliched, I would say, in its dialogue and in certain elements of the story.
Yeah, it's very him, I think. I know he's only directed two movies, but he previously wrote 20 Days Later and Sunshine, and he's also written for stuff like Never Let Me Go and the Dread movie. But I think there's two things that sort of categorize his work, is that there's definitely this sort of like kind of remix nature to them, where like 28 Days Later is a bit like somebody read Day of the Triffids and watched all the Romero zombie movies and then squashed it all together.
Yeah.
And it's a very fun, zippy movie, and I'm like fully on board for all the genre frills, but when it starts saying we're all infected with rage or whatever, it's like, it's not really about that. And similarly, Sunshine is like, you know, someone watched Alien and Event Horizon in 2001 and doing their own version. And this is very similar. And I don't know if my lukewarm reaction to it is partly to the fact that I've just seen the same movies he has. So like, I've seen Solaris. I've seen Solaris. Okay. Mm. I've seen Stalker. I've actually read the book it was based on. And a lot of the ideas are sort of just cribbed from that. But it, like you were saying, it feels kind of thrown together. And I think with these movies, like especially ones that are about, well, quote-unquote hard sci-fi, which are usually do with some sort of alien intelligence, there's a certain amount of ambiguity that sort of goes with that kind of story. Like, I don't know what the end of 2001 means, but I'm happy to sort of go with it. But I think with those films and like the Tarkovsky movies and a movie like Under the Skin, which is also is sort of somewhat influenced by, is that you feel you're in safe hands, and you feel that like it was made with like a lot of purpose and intellect behind all the decisions. Whereas this does feel a bit like slightly made up. Like the sort of the concept of like crazy stuff happens in the Shimmer just means like, well, and now a zombie bear will turn up because the plot slowed down.
Yeah.
And it ends with a bit of ambiguity where it didn't make me want to go back and like rethink the movie. I was just like, wow,
okay,
that passed the time and
yeah,
went down easy. And
I think it's almost like the way that Christopher Nolan approaches these types of things. I mean, maybe it feels like a bit of a stretch to compare it to Interstellar, but I think that's, or even like the end of Inception or something, there's some similarities with that. But it's like, you know, in the way that Christopher Nolan, when he was making Interstellar, was kind of making his like 2001.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But 2001 is this, you know, opaque. It is the obelisk. The film is the obelisk. It's just this like weird sort of transcendent experience that defies explanation and is deliberately made in such a way that you feel like it could all mean something, but it just like evokes that like numinous sense that you're, you know, being exposed to the beyond or something like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the film doesn't explain everything, but it's ambiguous in a way that does enough to convince you that there's a lot, there's something
there.
There's
a meaning to go for.
It's been made with a kind of spiritual purpose, or like there's some sort of mysticism to it. And that kind of thing doesn't exist at all in Christopher Nolan's style. And so his version of it is kind of funny because everything is explained, you know? And like it all works, and it's all like a kind of, I mean, there's plot holes and stuff, but it's all like you can see how it's all laid out.
It's all constructed.
And I think like this movie is a similar kind of thing, where like the movie is about this like unknowable alien thing that, you know, can't be comprehended by humans, and they have to kind of deal with it. But the movie doesn't feel like that attitude at all. It feels like an incredibly human thing that seems very comprehensible, and like,
yeah,
it doesn't have like this, you know, weird thing behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that his direction is a little flat, and it just has this sort of tone which it establishes and just does not vary from for the entire film.
Yeah, it's very monotonous in a literal sense.
It's kind of interesting because there's like a sort of action sequence right at the start, and it's not shot like an action sequence, and it just makes for this like slightly off-kilter feeling. But, you know, that is less effective four times more than that. You know, it works once, and then it's like, oh, it's just, this is the only trick the movie has. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just like a fun ride. And the production design is really interesting, and it's a bit like all the production heads are doing a great job. And I think just because of the sort of blank canvas of the world, it's like, make some crazy shit. And they're like, job
yeah,
done.
And they've
like,
done, they have done a great job.
And the special effects by Double Negative, who did Ex Machina and Doctor Strange, and this British company, who were very, very good. And like all the CGI is like, I think, on a cut above most stuff you watch. Like, I feel like CGI animals is something that some people can do well and the other movies just like completely suck at, and this one had like really good photorealistic stuff. I know that's a bit of a, you know, I like the effects.
And but they're very good.
I think the characters are a little bland, but the actors are all very charismatic, and it is cool that they're all women, and it's cool how that's not really there's like one line that remarks upon it, and then it's just like not a thing. It's cool how it's not a thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I mean the movie would work the same with gender swapping, basically.
Absolutely, and so I thought it was just fine.
It's just fine. Yeah. It's very Netflixy in that way, almost makes sense that they bought it, so it's like another thing that makes for a good trailer and doesn't provoke a strong reaction.
Yeah, but a bit more slickly made than,
yes, I agree, more like better made than Mute, than a film they actually funded.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Sam and Danny both watched a film and they decided to record a few opinions on the things they saw. You're gonna hear them in a moment or so. There could be angry disagreements, but their views are normally quite close. A joint review shared between two podcast brothers. Do they let one another speak, or do they interrupt each other? The light is on, the guys are in, so let the chat begin. Start talking now.
So, You Were Never Really Here, this is the film by Lynn Ramsey. She last made We Need to Talk About Kevin, and that was quite a long time ago. She's back with another kind of wordy title where you can put the emphasis on different individual words in it, depending on how you feel like you want to pronounce it. She almost made Jane Got a Gun, right?
Yeah, and then walked away like 2 days before production was supposed to start or something.
Yeah, because she, it was not given away, and then they turned it into some, like, I sort of have the impression that she was going to make some incredible, like, arty action thriller film like she's now made, and instead she left, and then they turned it into a generic movie that flopped. And anyway, so it's really great that she's been able to make a film, presumably to her own specifications. When You Talk About Kevin was brilliant. It's also a very rare example of a film that's better than the novel that it's based on. And this is also based on a novel, the book of the same name by Jonathan Ames, and Joaquin Phoenix is the star, and he plays a guy called Joe, who's a former FBI agent who's got post-traumatic stress disorder. And now moonlights as a kind of hitman or hired gun or, criminal
soldier of fortune.
Fixer, soldier of fortune type. And he lives with his extremely elderly mother. It really struck me in the movie how old that woman is. And he is hired early on in the movie to rescue a senator's daughter who has gone missing and is, holed up in a house of ill repute. And he has to go and sort that out and, enters the underworld and shit spirals from there. Here is a clip of him meeting the senator as he explains the mission he wants him to go on.
235 East 31st Street. That's what the text said. You have kids, Joe?
No.
Nina. Her name is Nina. I've heard of these places. Underage girls.
Senator, if she's there, I'll get her.
Cleary said you were brutal.
I can be.
It's quite funny because from that plot description, it implies some sort of like Taken 4 or something.
Yeah.
It's the most like generic sounding plot. It could be like a Sin City thing. And what's so kind of thrilling about the movie is the way it completely subverts any expectation you have of the genre.
It does, but it also kind of delivers. It delivers on the genre thrills.
Deliver on the genre thrills, but in very unconventional ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
The way the action is shot just gets more and more unconventional as the movie goes on.
It does, that's true.
In a way that's kind of brilliant. Yeah, I read a good sort of pithy summation of the film. It's like, it's a hitman movie more focused on the man than the hit. And it's actually this kind of first-person character piece about an extremely depressed, suicidal man. I mean, I think the first shot is him trying to commit suicide. And I thought it was amazing. I watched it at London Film Festival.
It's really good. I thought it was excellent as well.
And it's such a... If you're familiar with Lynn Ramsey's style, if you've seen We Need to Talk About Kevin or her previous other movies, Morven Keller and Ratcatcher, they all have this distinctly her thing of just like a collection of images, very impressionistic, hard to put into words, but good as cinema, where like, all these little images form a sort of character.
Well, does she have a background as an artist or something? Because like, there's something about... The fascination with image, and especially with objects, and like extreme close-ups of little things like hair and you know, just shit on desks and all this random stuff, which suggests like all these things were intended to be photographs that are hung in a gallery. But I think that what's so brilliant about her style is the way that this does not, it really doesn't feel like it's just, you know, I'm more interested in like pictures than people, or I'm more interested in people than stories or something like that. Like, it all is in service of the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very, very compelling. It's not just like, because it also, you know, in a way that the story sounds pulpy, and you describe her style and it sounds pretentious, but it doesn't feel that way at all.
Yeah, not at all. And it's also, I feel like, well, she's only made 4 films, but it's almost like her style taken the nth degree, in that it's like pared down to like the bone, the movie, in terms, it's only 90 minutes. And it's a bit like, you know, a picture paints 1,000 words, but it's like 10 frames paints a 20-minute flashback.
Yeah.
The way it sort of flashes, you know, flashbacks can be so cheesy, but it has like these tiny little stabs of like memories that are incredibly effective. And it's got like plot-wise, the comparisons you can make with Taxi Driver. And I think it is, I mean, I haven't seen that many movies that do this, but like, since, I don't know how many first person movies there have been of note since Taxi Driver, but I feel it's kind of like up there in like a portrait of one man's sort of descent into hell and then descent out of it. Descent out?
Ascent? Ascent from hell?
No, dig up, you idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and holding it all together is Joaquin Phoenix's like totally mesmerizing performance.
It's great. I love this guy. I mean, He's giving it absolutely everything. It is a very full-on performance. He's quivering with some kind of intense emotion every second that he's on screen, basically. He's never relaxed. He's always about to, like, cry or laugh or scream or, like, beat someone to death. It's very compelling to watch. I mean, it's, like, it's mega acting, you know? It's, like, Nicolas Cage-type sort of super acting.
Yeah.
But it's great stuff.
And I feel like it's the character which is the best sort of vehicle for his thing as an actor, because to be very reductive, he can, you know, he can be the lead in Her as a sort of sweet computer guy, and he can be like the insane guy from The Master, and it, like, his character in the movie in a way kind of oscillates between like moments of like savage brutality and like real like tenderness.
His
relationship with his mom is like very sweetly sketched out, and I'm like, she must have like, you know, well, the whole movie is so pared down, she must have like, you know, minute, like 10 minutes of screen time, if that. And you get this whole sense of a relationship. There's a bit where they're absolutely just like cleaning cutlery, and it's like adorable.
And they're singing together.
And singing, and then he's smashing a guy's skull in. Like, and I think there's a very Lynn Ramsey thing. If you can, like, you know, she's made 4 movies, so we can call it a hallmark, is just like this real affection for her characters.
Mm.
And there's so much like empathy towards Joe as this damaged human being. It's very palpable. Now, that's something else that kind of like throws you off guard. I mean, this like cold-blooded man who's haunted by his ghost, but it's just like, seems to have genuine concern for his well-being. Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big part of what makes the movie so good, is that it is the cliche, really, of the guy, the hitman with the damaged past or whatever, which you've sort of seen like a million times, or any like kind of noirish film. It's the same kind of shit, or even like a story about like a grizzled old person who'd given up on themselves. You know, it's like Logan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Finding the, like, they're brought back to humanity by like a child who they have to protect. And that's massively cliched. But it's definitely like, it's what you say, like the force of her interest in him as a person. And she obviously cares about, you feel like she cares about him so much. And she's much more interested in his, like, you know, psychology than she is in the violence. Although it is quite well executed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's fun. Like, it is a fun movie. It's not like the violence happens in the background, but the tears happen, you know, ultra close up. But
yeah, I think she's just one of those directors where she's got such a, her style is so interesting that you just, I would love to see a Lynn Ramsey sci-fi movie. I want to see a Lynn Ramsey, you know, rom-com. I want to, you know, like, she's like a genre unto herself, and seeing her sort of like flex her muscles in like this, I don't know, low rent hitman movie is awesome.
The other thing that's that she's really good at is just it's very evocative and very, very moody. And we need to talk about Kevin. I haven't seen her previous 2 movies, but in that movie, the whole movie is like suffused with dread.
Oh my god!
And she manages to wring like extraordinary amounts of dread out of the most like quotidian stuff, like, you know, just toast that's been dropped on the floor or something. You're like, oh my god, that's the most evil thing I've ever seen. Or it's just like a shot of a baby glaring at you, and it's like, that baby's gonna fucking kill someone. It's horrifying.
It's like the baby from The Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly. It's the monobrow baby from The Simpsons. But she's such an evocative filmmaker, and it's the same thing in this movie, but it's like the movie is so suffused with this like potential threat of violence all the time. And even though it's not very violent in terms of the actual stuff that you see happen on screen, it just feels like it is.
Yeah.
Because it's constantly hanging over the film.
Well, kind of, it successfully like his inner conflict puts you into his head.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, like, I just had no idea what he was going to do next, that guy.
Well, it's like, it's not just so much that you feel like you're in his shoes or whatever, but you feel like the whole world is a representation of his psyche.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's brilliantly done.
Yeah, I think, and like, key to that is like Johnny Greenwood's score. Another A-star score from Greenwood in a matter of months, robbed by Des Blatt at the Oscars. And yeah, his sort of weird synthy throw a chair at a dog, you know, play that sound backwards, put a guitars over it. I don't know how he does it, but I feel like everyone tries to do a sort of Johnny Greenwood score. It's become very in vogue, this kind of slightly, you know, unconventional instruments, whatever. But he's still just like, I don't know, knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, absolutely. Annihilation had a bit of that.
Yeah.
A bit like the Mika Levy score from Under the Skin, actually, as well.
Yeah, exactly. Both of them. I think they're like the proper ones, and everyone's trying to do a bit like, you know, the crazy multi-instrumentalist pop star sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, it's excellent. Also, I mean, because you mentioned the flashbacks, just made me realize like how much better the flashbacks are in You Were Never Really Here than they are in Annihilation.
Yeah.
It's like that movie's got long, boring flashbacks. They're full scenes where they talk about nothing. And this movie is just these little impressionistic glimpses, and you have to kind of piece together after the fact. It's actually kind of fun coming out of the movie and being like, so what, you know?
Yeah, it's a film
that kind of gives you enough information to kind of figure out what exactly had happened in his past, and you kind of
I've seen it twice, and they really rewarded repeat viewings precisely for that matter. I would say, like, to give a little puffy
make it puffy
it's such like an assault on the senses. There's so little information you have to piece together that it is a bit like you've watched a four-hour movie that's been condensed into 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's been blasted at you. And that is somewhat a unique experience. It's so cinematic. I know it's based on a book, but the book would, I imagine, sucks compared to this movie. Like,
well, that's a thing.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
Taking okay source material and just elevating it to the realms of superb cinema. Yeah, I think it's my favorite movie I've seen released this year. So if you place any stock in my opinion, I would urge you to seek it out.
Stop listening now. Stop now.
Go to your local multiplex.
Go there immediately. Demand they put it on.
Put it on. I don't care when you listen to this. You might be listening to this in the year 2065.
Get a print. Watch it now.
When Zach Braff heard something that changed his life, what he listened to? When John Cusack made a mixtape for his future wife, what did she listen to? And when Michael Madsen cut a guy's ear off, what was he dancing to? When Tim Robbins showed Shawshank that he had enough, which record did he choose? Yeah.
So Sam, I know you're a massive nerd. Look at you there in your Spider-Man pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
And your room is adorned with all your favorite Marvel films.
That's
which are
correct.
All the films.
Yes.
All the posters from all the films.
I do have all the posters from all the films.
Your Gmail account is DoctorStrangeRocks @gmail.com. So I assume you've seen the latest Avengers Infinity Wars trailer.
You know what, Danny? I have not seen the latest
Avengers
Infinity Wars trailer.
Oh my God, it's just exactly the same as the previous one. It's what you'd imagine.
Well, that's all you want when you go to see the Marvel
There's
films.
Some more quips. Star-Lord has a little bants
with
Iron Man.
Uh-huh.
And
finally, the two quippiest characters get to meet.
Peter Parker has a bit of bants with Doctor Strange.
Very good.
And there's a bit where Thanos is punching Captain America, and he's just holding his fist back with his crazy serum strength.
Nice.
Even though
it's
he's
like the
a
helicopter
god.
Thing from the Civil War.
And seems a lot of it set in Wakanda. It's a good thing they made that movie Black Panther, or that was a hit, because there's a lot of Wakanda in it by the looks of things.
Yeah, they would have had to have drastically changed the film if the movie had flopped. They're oh no, it's actually set in France. Wow, brilliant, man. I can't wait.
I mean, I'll see it probably.
Look, well, probably. Of course you're going to see it.
Yeah, but I'm going to watch all the 17 Marvel films beforehand.
Oh, yeah. Let's do a marathon. Marathon. Let's marathon it.
My favorite one is actually The Incredible Hulk, so get that in early.
I got that on DVD.
Sweet.
So
my sister's got Thor on DVD.
Okay. Well, maybe if we call all our friends. Each will have one of the films, and we can piece together at the full marathon.
Awesome. Can't wait.
Me neither, man. All right. Let's stop recording this podcast, because I got to watch that trailer. I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Okay, cool.
All right. Thanks for listening, okay. Friends.
Okay, thanks, friends. Bye.
Bye. See you next time.
Okay, Sam's watching the trailer.
This is very
live.
Popular, isn't it?
Yeah.
On YouTube to do this. 7 hours ago. All right, here we go. Okay, watching it now. The city is rotating and stuff. Do they have another split voiceover like in the first one? Universe. No, just ScarJo. Just ScarJo so far. Is that ScarJo? I know it's not. It's Zoe Saldana.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
There he is.
We got one advantage. He's coming to us.
Okay, they've got to fight Thanos. That's being set up.
So that's what we use.
Wow. Chris Evans is going for it, isn't he? The Avengers, yeah, it's the Avengers.
Let's talk about this plan of yours. I think it's good, except it sucks. So let me do the plan, and that way it might be really good. Wow.
There's the bands. You told me that there would be some bands. What? Oh my god! No! Oh, there was all the actors! Wow! Oh, I'm losing my mind! Oh, the YouTube's gonna love this! Watching me do this. I'm filming this as well. Oh, god! Thanos is gonna destroy the Earth! Oh, this is terrible. But the heroes are there, and they look great. They love it! Whoa! Hey! Yes! Woo! Woohoo! Oh, yeah! Oh, wow! Oh, boy! Good God! What a film! What a trailer! What a time to be alive!
I'm Peter, by the way.
Doctor Strange.
Oh, you're using your made-up names. Then I am Spider-Man.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.